Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight I am proud to bring you Spaced Out with Bob Vossler. Greetings and welcome, Bob. How are you?
Doing well. Looking forward to tonight's show.
As am I. I'll be here if you need me.
Jason, are you here?
Yes. Hello, Bob. Good evening.
I was almost late because I was rewatching the video you made today at work. Jason, I've been wanting to do this segment for more than a year now, but much like No Time to Die, it has gotten postponed, and for the same reason, this darn pandemic. So,
yes. Yeah, it was actually, there was a lot of delays. It was actually originally supposed to come out in November of 2019, but because they had to change directors, they moved it to Valentine's Day 2020, and then the film wasn't finished, so they moved it to April 2020, and then in March of 2020, COVID moved it, and then COVID moved it again and again and again. So finally, it came out October.
I'm glad we finally get to see it, although we will get to unpacking everything that happened in it
in a little bit.
But I wanted to, you are the uber James Bond fan. I mean, you know, you are James Bond to what I am in Star Trek.
Sure.
So let's first talk about how your love of James Bond came about, because it was at a pretty early age, from what I understand, from the photos I've seen.
Yes, believe it or not, it was when I was 4 and a half, about to turn 5, and my mother wasn't entirely thrilled about it, but my grandfather got me introduced to Bond. He had them all on VHS. He had taped them off of TV from ABC when they would air them. And so they were edited, you know, some of them were edited for content and everything else. But I started watching these at a really, really early age, and I got hooked. I got hooked on all of the films that were out at that point, the music, and I ate it all up. And it was one of those things where it just became this lifelong obsession with, you know, collecting memorabilia and going to conventions and meeting celebrities who appeared in the films and just becoming almost like a walking encyclopedia of Bond knowledge. So it's been a long journey for sure.
Yeah, and you met the original Q, who was with, you know, Connery, Moore, Dalton, Brosnan. What was he? I don't recall now, and I'm pretty good on Bond stuff myself, but clearly not as much as you. You are the master, but was he in on Her Majesty's Secret Service? I don't recall that.
Yes, he was. He was actually in the opening sequence, and he was also at the wedding at the end of the movie.
Oh, that's right.
He was.
I've forgotten that. Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah.
Where Monty Penny was crying. Yeah.
Yes, and believe it or not, it's kind of funny that we're doing this podcast this evening. I actually met Desmond Llewellyn, who played Q, 26 years ago tomorrow, because 26 years ago tomorrow was the GoldenEye convention, and then the 13th of November was actually the world premiere at Radio City Music Hall, and I attended both. And it was the thrill of a lifetime, for sure. And it's funny that we're doing this tonight, 26 years to the day, practically.
Wow. And I know you've got a lot of memorabilia in your office, and probably the books. But tell us a little bit about some of the treasures that you have, and how you acquired them, and where you got them.
Sure. So I have a lot of the cars and some of the dolls, the figures, and things like that. A bevy of books and magazines, and also it was screen used, but there were so many made of the casino chips that were seen in the Isthmus Casino and License to Kill, and those are actually on my desk at the office, so I have those. So that's pretty cool. And I even have some original cassette tapes of the soundtracks and also all the scores and everything else on compact disc and everything else. So it's just there's a lot of stuff in that menagerie for sure.
Now, do you have – one of the only few things that I have from James Bond is those terribly painted plastic figurines that came out, I guess, in the mid-60s. They had, you know, Connery Bond in his white tuxedo top and, you know, Monty Penny, Goldfinger, you know, Dr. No. I mean, I believe I have them all, but they were the first one I got was the Connery one, and I saw it at the Casino Pier Arcade, and that's where I went to play skee ball. And that's, you know, of all the crap they had there, I had to have that. I didn't care how many, you know, tickets it took or how many games of skee ball that I had to pay for. And I was so happy to get the Connery Bond, which like a year later,
yeah,
my dog Smokey ate his head off, ate Sean Connery's, you know, Sean Connery's head off. And I was, you know, it took me decades to find him all over again. And I got him at a convention or something, but I finally, you know, bought him back. And I did have, I believe it was Corgi or Matchbox. I think it was Corgi that had the Aston Martin with the ejector seat. And I played with it so often that the ejector, you know, the roof came off. So I had to replace it. And it had less fancy tires, bigger plastic tires. They weren't as nice as the original car. But you know, knowing me, I didn't throw out the broken one. I had to keep that too. But I still have it upstairs in the attic. But
yeah, some of those are certainly treasures for sure. I don't have any of those. Believe it or not, my collection mostly is magazines and books and things that I've collected from conventions over the years. Because a lot of times, by the time I ended up at the conventions, the actual toys and things were so expensive because they were rarities. Now, if you go on eBay, eBay has kind of changed the world of collecting in a lot of ways, because a lot of times people put stuff up there. They have no idea what it's worth, what they could get for it. And ultimately, they undersell it for themselves. They lose out on some money opportunity. But it gives the fan a chance to pick up something that they might not be able to get before. So I don't really have anything too rare, but it's nice to have this stuff. I sometimes go back and take a look, nostalgic purposes and everything else. It's kind of a nice thing.
Well, I know, and I'm older than you, probably much older than you, but I remember the days when I was very young, going through probably a Two Guys or something, and I did have the Man from U.N.C.L.E., you know, like G.I. Joe size, not the tiny G.I. Joes, but the original G.I. Joe sized, probably 12-inch doll action figures,
yeah,
whatever you want to call them. And I know there was a Connery Bond figure, and I saw it once and wanted to eat. And even though I was probably too young to have seen Bond at that time, all I knew was, that's cool, I want it. And then the next time I went, it was not there. So I kicked myself then. But then again, I was a kid, so what was I going to do? Have a
Oh, yeah, it's the same thing with anything. Yeah, you, hindsight is always 20/20 for sure.
Now, let's go on to, like, talk about your favorite Bond, which I think we both have the same favorite Bond, but, you know, what's your favorite Bond and your favorite Bond film, which could be two different things, you know?
Yeah, and, you know, it's really, really, it's a very double-loaded, triple-loaded, quadruple-loaded question, because I have to start off by saying that all of the actors who have played James Bond have brought something different to the role, and each one of them, I've enjoyed their performances. So it's very, very hard to nail it down of who a favorite is and everything else. But I do have to say that of all the interpretations of Bond in terms of the book Bond and you know, a combination, in my opinion, of the book Bond along with the film Bond would be Timothy Dalton. And it's not a very popular choice. It's kind of one of those things where you tell someone, and a lot of times the casual moviegoer fan will say, really? And then the diehard fans often will say, oh, yeah, you know, he's either my second to Connery, or, you know, he preferred him over, you know, Roger Moore or even Pierce Brosnan. So it's an interesting thing because I really love all of the portrayals from each actor, but Dalton is like my top, then followed by Connery. I love Craig, but I also love Moore's films too. And that's the difficult part. It's just not fair because, you know, I have a soft spot for Moonraker, and Moonraker is considered one of those turkeys of the series. And, you know, if I'm bored or I'm doing some work at home or whatever, the kids are asleep, I'll pop on Moonraker just to, you know, to have a good laugh and enjoy it and escapism and everything else. But then again, you know, I also love a Goldfinger. Goldfinger is my favorite Connery Bond. Obviously, The Spy Who Loved Me and Fear Eyes Only are great Moore films. Dalton, I love License to Kill and The Living Daylights equally. You know, Brosnan, GoldenEye is fantastic, and the other ones are good. I mean, Die Another Day is probably the one that I have watched the least after seeing it the five times in the theater. That's the one that I, you know, with the invisible car and a lot of the jumping the shark kind of things, I kind of look at that as a big mess of a movie. There's parts of it that are just fantastic, and then there are parts of it where I'm like, what the hell were they thinking? And then, you know, obviously the Daniel Craig films, Casino Royale was incredible. Quantum, I enjoyed mostly. You know, it grew on me. It took a little time, but it's grown on me. Skyfall is a masterpiece, in my opinion. Spectre it's gotten better, I think, with multiple viewings. And No Time to Die, we'll get to that later, but that's also a mixed bag. But, you know, I always say that every actor and every movie has its good points, and it's a very hard thing to nail down.
Oh, absolutely. I think the Roger Moore movies for me, I mean, I completely agree because I've enjoyed them all. Some I liked a little bit more than others, but there's never been a Bond that I wasn't, well, until recently, that I wasn't completely satisfied with. You know, the Roger Moore era, I think, was, you felt more comfortable with that era in that you didn't, it was played a little bit more tongue-in-cheek, but there was still danger, there were certainly thrills, there was action, there was everything in a Bond movie, but somehow you always kind of knew, you know, you were comfortable with the formula, and you knew how things were going to go. Pretty much.
Yeah, and one of the things about Moore that I love is the fact that every one of his films, I would say that they're the most fun of them all in terms of, you know, you're watching a Cold War spy movie, you're going to watch From Russia with Love, you're going to watch, you know, classic Connery and original, the whole thing. Mm-hmm. But if you want to have, you know, a good, you know, 2 hours of escapism and the quips and the jokes and a great villain and everything else, the Roger Moore films are the most fun of the series. You know, then you get into the more serious territory, more like the Fleming Bond, more like the book Bond. You know, you go with a Dalton, you go with a Craig. You know, Brosnan was kind of like, if you took all the actors, you put them in a blender and you see what came out. And, you know, there were good and bad points about his role, mostly about some of the scripts that he was getting, because it just felt in a lot of ways that they were building the movie around a big action piece rather than a story. And that, I think, suffered especially later on with a lot of the Pierce Brosnan ones. But, you know, they're just great fun, all of them. And, you know, and I think also what's interesting is a lot of times it also depends on when you grew up. So, for example, when I was 5 years old, I saw The Living Daylights with Dalton in the theater, and that was my first experience of seeing a James Bond movie on the big screen. And believe it or not, I was five, but I remember it. I was, you know, five and a half, and I am remember the experience of going to the Sheepshead Bay movie theater. It was the United Artists Theater that just opened up in Brooklyn. And it was a brand new theater. And I actually remember the poster being on the wall, walking in there with my parents. And it's one of those things that just stayed with me. And I think, you know, you talk generational. A lot of times, if someone was born in the late 60s and they grew up with Roger Moore in the 70s, Roger Moore is their guy. Same thing with Connery. If you were born in the 40s and 50s and you were around for the 60s with Connery as Bond, you know, he's your favorite. So, you know, and then anybody born basically after 19... Yeah, anybody born after 1987 is going to go with Brosnan because that's the Bond they grew up with. So I think a lot of times it really does depend on when you were, you know, around for that.
Well, Moore was the one, even though I'm sort of the middle child because I was born too late for Connery. That's why it was exciting last year when I got to see Dr. No on the big screen, because obviously I never saw it on the big screen or whatever. I was too busy in a cradle or something. So Moore is when I started to, like, you know, it became a summer experience, because usually for the Moore era, I believe they were all summer movies. They were always the summer blockbuster movies.
Yes.
Until they later moved to, like, November, which I, you know, I still always prefer them being summer.
Yeah, I think I'm trying to, from the memory bank, I want to say that Live and Let Die was a June movie. I want to say The Man with the Golden Gun was a Christmas movie. And then The Spy Who Loved Me moved back to the summer. And then basically all the Moore films then were summer blockbusters. You know, even A View to a Kill came out in May of 85. So there was, you know, there were summer experiences basically every 2 years, you know, and another one would come out.
Yeah. You knew you were getting a Bond movie every other year. Like you could bank on that.
And the only long gap back then was, you know, between Cubby Broccoli and Harry Saltzman's breakup in 74. So after The Man with the Golden Gun, there was a little bit more delay, but then you had a movie in 77, 79, 81, 83, and 85. And then Dalton came in for 87 and then 89. So they, like you said, it was clockwork. You could almost set your clock in your calendar. Oh, it's time for a Bond again, you know, that kind of thing.
Just a non sequitur. I, the only Bond actor I got to meet was, Jaws, you know.
Oh, Richard Kiel. Oh, great.
Richard Kiel, and he was great. I remembered he had like a bump on his head, like in the middle of his forehead. I don't know what he did, but he probably didn't feel it. He was a very friendly guy. He was laughing a lot, and you know, he was just amazing. Had pretty long hair at that point. Remember at that convention? It was I forgot what convention it was at, but. You know, it was just great to see him. You know, it's been a phenomenal run for James Bond. And it's always provided some great villains, some better than others. But and it's hard to pinpoint your favorite villain. And some, like Blofeld, have been played by, you know, different actors. It took a while for one actor to actually play the part more than once, you know, because we had Telly Savalas, we had Max von Sydow, we had that character alone. Is there any particular villains that you thought worked? And I mean, Christopher Lee was supposed to be Bond, is from a rumor I heard.
Was one of those, I think one of those, like, kind of like wives' tale kind of things, because I know that his cousin was Ian Fleming. And I think at one point they had said, oh, you know, what do you think about Christopher Lee? And it was more like, well, you know, he'd be a great villain, but we're not really interested. So there was a lot of that back and forth talk, which sometimes comes out. But I would say, you know, there was so many great villains in the films, you know, the top ones for me. Obviously, you know, Goldfinger is pretty much the gold standard, no pun intended. I absolutely love Telly Savalas as Blofeld in On Her Majesty's Secret Service. And I actually got to meet Telly Savalas back in 1993.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, he was my uncle was the one of the managers of the Sheraton Universal Hotel, where Telly liked to stay. And when I was out there, and this was, you know, a couple of years, I think about a year before he passed away, he was actually sitting in this lounge watching a football game. And, you know, they said, hey, you want to meet Blofeld? I'm like, yeah, you know, that kind of thing. So they brought me over to him. There was a commercial break on the football game. He actually turned the TV off and sat there with me for a few, you know, probably a half hour, answering all my questions. And, you know, and I think he was absolutely stunned that this kid, you know, of like, you know, 11 and 12 kind of knew all this stuff, not only about Bond, but about, you know, Talkie Tina from Twilight Zone and Kojak and all this other stuff, because I was kind of, I was very worldly even at that age with this kind of stuff. So that was a great experience to be able to, you know, basically shake hands with Blofeld for real. And then, obviously I love the Strombergs. I love Hugo Drax from Moonraker, you know, Julian Glover in Fear Eyes Only is terrific. Louis Jordan in Octopussy is great. I love Christopher Walken in A View to a Kill. I would have to say that a lot of the Moore villains were kind of like on the level of the favorites. And then, Robert Davi as Sanchez in License to Kill was fantastic. And, you know, Sean Bean in Goldeneye. So there was a lot of really great villains, you know, baddie performances that were just really top notch. And, you know, and like I said, there's so much to love about these movies. And, you know, you can literally go on for hours about it, you know, in every experience.
And Bond itself has become so iconic. I mean, I recently saw a wonderful film, actually, which I don't think is doing as well as I think it should, called Last Night in Soho, which is a kind of a thriller ghost story. But it really captures, because without giving too much away, it kind of, there's a little time displacement of the mid-1960s, and one of the opening scenes is the Marquis of Thunderball.
I heard about that.
The music and the way it was shot and the mystery behind it, I thought it was one of the best movies I've seen this year. In that it kept you on your seat. And I don't want to digress too much, but it's a mystery. It's a ghost story. You follow it along. Any movie that can just like throw a curveball in there, I appreciate. But just seeing the Thunderball, that one quick scene, like immediately set like, okay, 1960s, mid 1960s. And I was like, when did Thunderbolt come out again? Because now I have to know exactly.
1965. Yep.
You know, smacked in the middle of the 60s, and so well done.
Sure.
Just such a well done movie. Which, speaking of Thunderball, and I know that you kind of consider this non canon, and it probably is, but Never Say Never Again was the remake. of Thunderball, and I know the whole story behind, you know, the rights between that and Connery wanting to, you know, I guess at that point wasn't getting along with the Broccolis or I don't know.
There was a whole to-do about that. There was also the issue with, you know, who really wrote Thunderball. Was it Ian Fleming? Was it Kevin McClory? Who actually came up with the story that was turned into the book and, you know, the screenplay and all that kind of stuff. There was a lot of litigation about it. It was basically a lengthy, lengthy court battle that lasted most of that guy's life. And then eventually it was settled, when they were able to make Spectre and they got the rights to it and everything else. But it was pretty much, it was like almost like the real life Blofeld to the Broccoli family, because there were fights about the rights over it for years. And, you know, Connery was never happy that he wasn't made like a producing partner with Broccoli and Saltzman. They did not want to partner with him. They wanted to keep everything separate. They also, in a lot of ways, from a lot of resources and things that we've heard over the years, that he had a really lousy deal where he lost a lot of money in terms of what he could have made playing the part, especially with merchandising. And he had an axe to grind. And what one of the things that they got was, hey, you want to stick it to Broccoli, come and do this movie. And the sticky wicket was that they released it in 83 with Octopussy also the same year.
Yeah.
And believe it or not, you know, the thing that was absolutely amazing was the fact that Octopussy did better at the box office than Never Say Never Again did. And it proved that James Bond is bigger than the actor. It's not, you know, it's, and now we'll get to that coming up when we talk about the new film. There's a whole thing about that where, you know, James Bond is not Sean Connery. Sean Connery plays James Bond, but James Bond is James Bond, and you cannot have it both ways. And the box office numbers from that proved it, because all the elements were missing, you know, the themes and the gun barrel and the title and, you know, all of that. And you know, the one redeeming quality of Never Say Never Again is that Barbara Carrera is absolutely fantastic in that. I think she I wish she had done Octopussy as the title role, because she was offered that. And they gave, you know, she basically said, she wanted to do, she wanted to work with Connery. So that's why she chose to do the other one. So in hindsight, I don't know if she, she regrets that decision. I haven't actually talked to her, but I actually do know someone who's one of her managers. So I could probably find out, but I do know that, she was originally offered that. And then when Maude Adams was called into audition, I guess a bunch of actors like James Brolin tried out for Bond and all this other stuff, they offered her the part at that point because they said, look, you have great chemistry. We want to get Roger back for another one. And that's pretty much how she got the part, you know, being this, the at that point, really the only time aside from Sylvia Trench from Dr. No coming back into From Russia with Love, where a Bond actress would appear in more than one film, obviously, until we get to the present day with the new film. So that's another sidebar.
I found the movie interesting in that, you know, we see an older Bond, you know, who was, you know, training younger, you know, he was feeling it. He got stabbed because he was getting a little rusty.
I thought
it was an interesting opening. I did like the music. I think that would have worked had it been an actual, you know, regular Bond movie. You know, it's not one of my super favorites, but I am glad that they made it. But you know, and I do wish that there had been more Dalton movies. You know, I wish that would have happened. But that said, let's move into the Daniel Craig era. Before we get to No Time to Die, you know, it was an interesting period for us all as Bond fans. Casino Royale was very good, but for the first time we got to see Bond's origin, so to speak, you know, as far as on film, which I thought was, you know, interesting, you know, right down to the black and white opening kind of thing. But to see the existing M, that's what threw me, because, you know, clearly in Brosnan was Bond, you know, was 007 and had a different Bond, and she's new. This time she's the boss and he's new. So, but I guess that's because I guess she had a contract, you know, in her contract, she was due another Bond movie or something. I'm assuming that's what happened.
It was basically one of the things was that they were concerned that by not having Moneypenny and Q in Casino and not having someone familiar to kind of bridge the gap or turn the tide, that it would kind of be a shock to the audience in a way that would be a problem. And also the M of the Brosnan films is not the same M in the Craig films. It's not the same character. They actually have different names. The name of the M from GoldenEye to Die Another Day, her name was Barbara Maudsley. and in the Craig film, she's Olivia Mansfield. So there is a different, you know, even though the mannerisms were basically the same and she was pretty much playing the M almost in the same way, although she was kind of, I would say, nicer in a way to the Brosnan Bond than she was with Craig. She was more tough with Craig, more like a motherly kind of figure. I think because Judi Dench is just a wonderful actress, the fact that she's in those films as well, just it's one of those highlights. You know, I really, you know, in terms of M's, she's really high on the list for me in her performance and everything else. And even with Skyfall, it was just the way they went about certain things with that. That was just a great, great film all around.
And we get Quantum of Solace, which is, you know, picks up almost immediately, you know, if not immediately, right after Casino Royale. And we've never had that before, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that was a first.
Majesty's Secret Service and Diamonds Are Forever, you know, with Connery coming back.
Yeah.
There's a span of time, and they almost kind of, you know, they almost kind of forget what happened. You know, like they played down the fact that, you know, Bond's wife was killed, you know, like.
Yes, yeah. It's very interesting how the film Bond is, in a way, jumping all over the place, because even they shot a lot of the things out of order. So, you know, when You Only Live Twice, he meets Blofeld in person, but then in On Her Majesty's, he doesn't recognize him when he, you know, pretends to be Sir Hilary Bray at the clinic. You know, it's one of those things where that was an epic flaw on their part, and it probably, you know, would confuse the audience of today. Back then, I think a lot of people were more accepting of that because not everybody read the books. And, you know, if you can separate the two as saying that this is a cinematic Bond and this is a book Bond, and, you know, you like both, you have those elements, then it's totally fine. But with Quantum, it was such a, you know, the thing that's so interesting about Quantum is the fact, like you said, you know, at the end of Casino, he's standing there over Mr. White's got the gun. He says, name's Bond, James Bond. The next movie opens up with a car chase. The man is still in the trunk. This is actually moments after he puts him in the car. So, you know, and that was a very, very daring move, considering that they obviously didn't plan to have an arc of movies that were all going to connect in some way. And, you know, in some way they probably should have planned it better, because then some things get a little hokey as we move forward, especially into the new film, that they really left a lot of things kind of like, you know, some imagination things that you have to go with just to retcon it to say, all right, well, I guess that could work, but it doesn't make much sense, you know? Those kinds of things,
yeah,
they come up.
Yeah, and when we get to Skyfall, I don't know how you took that, but and I know that that fell on Bond's 50th year in films. And it sort of had a different feel to it, because, and I think it was probably necessitated by the fact that it was the 50th year, because there Daniel Craig feels like, you know, he's been Bond for quite a while, or at least a while.
Yes.
Whereas the first two films, you know, he's a rookie as much as Bond could be a rookie. But it feels like, you know, I've been around for a while. You know, he puts the Aston Martin in a special garage and everything. I think, you know, but we do get to see Bond, some of his personal life, you know, some of his prior life.
And that was interesting. And if you don't mind, I'll just jump off with that too. The thing that when I left the theater, when I saw Spectre, when I saw Skyfall, aside from the very end where we meet the new M and we find out that you know, Naomi Harris is actually Moneypenny and everything else, through the movie, I kind of felt in a way like they were trying to say that the Craig of Skyfall is the original Bond later, because he's already older, he's already complaining, he's already, you know, they always talk about how he lost the step and this and that. He almost, in a way, is ready for retirement, blah, 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 blah. So, and when we see the car, I'm thinking to myself, all right, well, are they doing this as a throwback or as a nod, as a wink? Or is this part of the canon where now we're supposed to believe that the Craig Bond right this minute is really the Connery Moore and Dalton and connection Bond, or is this still the Craig Bond from Casino and we're just seeing him after years of service, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that was confusing to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And I think as we get into the new movie, especially lends itself to those same kinds of questions. But even things like with Spectre, when we get to Spectre, how, you know, Silva's character in Skyfall, there's no way he was working for Blofeld. He had an axe to grind with M. It had nothing to do with Spectre. The fact that they tried to maneuver that into as a thing, I thought that was really bad because I felt it cheapened
it. Yeah, because we were waiting for Spectre. You know. I think even in Casino Royale, we were starting to, you know, we were prepared for Spectre to reemerge, you know,
yeah,
for a few films. And I think Skyfall, because, you know, my theory was, and it's probably wrong, that the 50th year kind of threw them a curveball of saying, we got to do something that shows a kind of a compilation or history of Bond, you know, to be part of the anniversary year. So that's
sure.
where I said it kind of threw a monkey wrench into things, to what they really probably wanted to do, which was to do Spectre as the third movie, you know,
yeah,
and start to show, you know.
Yeah, and if memory serves me, I don't think they had the rights to Casino, not to Casino, to the Spectre brand just yet. So I think they had to wait to do that because they didn't actually have the rights yet for that. So, but I could be wrong on that. I think there was that kind of issue. I think there was a reason that they went with that one instead of the other one first. But then, you know, there are parts of Spectre that were also pretty good. But then, you know, in a way, ripping off the Austin Powers brother thing, I thought that was unforgivable. I think they didn't need to do that. And I'm still,
yeah,
to this day questioning why they
didn't. I didn't think that was necessary either. I mean, I think they chose a good actor to play Blofeld, but
yes,
I didn't like the whole brother connection thing. I just didn't think that was necessary. But now, you know, Spectre. Yeah, I should also mention that we're with the Craig movies, we're getting longer films. You know, no time,
yes,
was plenty of time. It was nearly 3 hours, but wasn't,
yes,
Spectre and Skyfall also fairly long?
They were up there. They were long movies. They were all very long movies, and all of them, you know, in terms of putting every dollar on the screen, they certainly did. But as far as the length, I think they were too long, each one. I think each one,
yeah,
ran probably 15 to 20 minutes too long in some way or another. And, you know, for a diehard Bond fan to say that the movie is too long, that is saying an awful lot. I think that's saying an awful lot.
Yeah, usually I like more, you know, no pun intended, I like more film. But it did seem like, you know, and I, you know, I did feel like, wow, this is a lot of good stuff, but it's still, you know, the flow just seemed a little off in comparison to the many other Bond films that felt like when they ended that they ended when they should have ended. Where here,
yes,
it's like, okay, more, especially this last one. This one had like,
yeah,
you know, it felt like the last or the second to last Star Wars movie where you had like three potential endings and it didn't,
yeah,
take, you know.
Or like there was that one Lord of the Rings movie that just, it had like five different endings and I'm like, oh, okay, it's over now. And it's like, it's not,
yeah,
over. And it just keeps going. And I'm like, okay. Okay.
Yeah, that's weird when you have that, especially when you're, you know, pre-pandemic, when you're in a movie experience in the theater and it's like, all right, I thought I was finally going to be able to break away and get to the bathroom now, but okay, yeah.
Not a chance.
Right? Yeah, but No Time to Die, you know, has a little bit of a time gap between Spectre a little bit of a time gap, and then we have a bigger time gap of 5 years later, you know,
yes,
after what we,
yes,
see. And, yeah, I'm going to let you talk about more on this because, you know, this is the first Bond movie, and I think it's your first Bond movie, where after seeing it, I was literally numb. I was walking out.
I had similar experience about that. Do you want to go first, or should I?
Well, all I can say is I think I think one of my coworkers, Chris, saved my life by leaving me a message where I had a call and put my attention towards the theft of Sandra Fortunato's car, and divert my attention to what I had, and immediately I told him, I said, Chris, you and I are going to have an interview. Poor Jason's going to need an intervention. He hasn't seen this movie yet, but when he does, he's going to need. I know the pandemic's been worse enough, but this is going to get you. You're really going to turn to dust when you see this movie.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's a good segue for me to start. I was obviously, this was a long-awaited film for me, as we discussed before, delayed many times. I was able to stay away from all spoilers, and I basically went in not knowing much about anything. I had seen pretty much two trailers. I heard the song because the song obviously came out a year before the movie because of the delays, and I pretty much went in not knowing much about anything. And I obviously am not comfortable going back into a movie theater, so I found out that the Delsey Drive-In in Vineland, New Jersey was showing it, and it's an hour and a half from my house. And I said, you know what, I'll go. And I had to sit through Addams Family 2, which was garbage. It's that new Addams Family where it's CGI, and it was just the worst movie I've ever seen. And it was like watching a train wreck, and I'm like, I just want to get this movie over so I can watch Bond and everything else. So the movie is finally over, and now I'm ready to see it. And believe it or not, basically you see the MGM lion roar, and then the white dots come on the screen, and he walks through the gun barrel, turns and shoots, and there's no blood. And I said, oh, my God. And at that point, I said to myself, oh, my God, this is going to be crazy. Because at that point, I said, oh, my God, that means basically on symbolism that he's going to die. That there's that something just at that point said, oh, my God, he's going to die. Because the whole point of that gun barrel sequence is that the two white dots symbolize a sniper's rifle going across the screen. The gun barrel opens up. He walks in. The sniper has him in the view, and he turns and shoots and kills the sniper before they have a chance to kill him. The blood shroud comes down, symbolizing basically the death of the sniper, and then the movie opens up. When the blood didn't come down, I said, holy shit. And obviously from the opening scene, it was pretty dramatic with Saffin with the mask and Madeline as a child and everything else. So I'm now on the edge of my seat to the point of my mouth is probably open. My teeth are probably falling out of my head. And now I'm watching this amazing spectacle, this incredible sequence in Matera. This, you know, obviously the Aston Martin car chase, the relationship, the fact that they used the song We Have All the Time in the World, the instrumental over the scene when they're driving. Yeah, and I'm sitting there, and I am literally excited, and my heart's pounding, and I love it. And the titles come on, the song is fantastic with the movie. At first, I wasn't entirely sure, but when you see it with the images of the opening credits, as usual, it's just stunning. And we get through, and I'm watching the movie, and I'm enjoying a lot of things, and I'm questioning a lot of things, and I'm wondering about a lot of things, and then I'm criticizing a lot of things in my mind, that I'm saying, wow, this is good, or wow, this is bad, or oh, that's a missed opportunity, or oh, hey, that's a cool throwback, or oh, is this the timeline that I had mentioned before, because now he's driving Dalton's Aston Martin, and now when, in MI6, you see Robert Brown's M on the wall next to Judy's, so are we now going and saying that he, in fact, was, the M before Judy took over. So is this really the Bond we knew from before? And I'm, all these things are going through my mind while I'm watching this. And I'm enjoying the movie. It's a stunningly made film. It looks fantastic on a big screen. They use the Panavision widescreen frame insanely well. And I'm watching it, and we're going through, and the music is great. And we get to the ending. And sure enough, and I didn't have a problem with James Bond having a daughter and not knowing about it. I didn't have a problem with any of that. I didn't have a problem seeing him getting emotional. But I do have a problem with them killing James Bond. I was absolutely stunned. It was the first time since Bond's wife got killed in On Her Majesty's that I actually cried during a Bond film. My eyes were like filling up with water. I couldn't control it. At one point, I thought it was the fact that my window was fogging from the drive-through because, you know, it was getting later and it was a cooler night.
I was stunned to see Felix Scott die. You know,
well, that too. All these things, and then I'm watching this ending, and he dies, and I'm a wreck, and we then see the scene where she's driving the daughter in the car, and they play We Have All the Time in the World over the end credits, and I stayed in the car watching the end credits with my mouth open and tears coming out of my head, and I'm like, holy shit, and I literally had to drive home at 1:30 in the morning alone on dark back roads where there's deer jumping out, and I'm in the car, my hands are gripped on the steering wheel, and I'm speaking loudly to myself. At some points I'm speaking loudly, at some points I'm yelling, at some points I'm crying, at some points I'm yelling some more, and I said, what the fuck? I'm like, holy cow, what the hell did they do? And I would have to say that this was the first movie that I have ever seen, of any kind of movie, that I loved and hated at the same time. And I've still, I was a wreck, Bob, for a week. After I saw this on a Friday night, okay?
I can imagine.
I saw it on
just, you know,
Friday
all
night,
I could think of is
and,
you.
And by the time, Monday came around and I had to go to work, I was a wreck. And Stu called and he says, how you doing? I said, I'm all right. He said, you don't sound right. I'm like, I'm okay. Yeah, that's fine. I literally was a wreck for a week. And then once you know the spoilers and then once you know what happens, then you can digest it more. You can listen to podcasts. You could read reviews. You could read comment forums. You could talk to your other Bond community friends. I'm in every Facebook group you could think of. And it was a mixed bag. There were people who absolutely loved the movie, including the ending. There are people who loved the whole movie but hated the ending. There are people who hated the whole movie from top to bottom. And there are people who loved everything about it but, you know, weren't sure about some of the things in it. And I could honestly say, and one of the things that I keep hearing from a lot of people was that they hated it on the first viewing, but when they saw it again, like two or three times, it grew on them and they understood things better and they could digest it more, and now it's in their top tier. Now, I don't know if that's going to happen with me. This is the first Bond film since GoldenEye, since License to Kill, that I only saw once in the theater. Every other Bond film, starting with GoldenEye and on, I would see anywhere from 5 to 15 times in the theater. This movie I've only seen once because it's already out of the drive-thru, and it's already streaming on home video, on, you know, home streaming platforms as of this week. So I'm not paying $20 to rent it where I could only watch it for 48 hours. It's coming out to own in December. So in December, I'll buy it, I'll rewatch it a million times, and I'm hoping that my opinion changes. But, you know, in a weird symbolic way, Bob, I felt like a piece of my childhood was killed off.
That's
not sitting well with me. Yeah,
that's exactly how I felt. And I think they intentionally did the symbolism of you know, the mother-daughter going on that winding road, and all it, plus with the music, it reminded me the winding road that we saw with you know, Lazenby and Tracy, you know,
yep.
driving there and then stopping and then getting gunned down, you know.
Yeah.
So the symbolism worked like double depression, you know, like
yes.
you could relive
and
Tracy's death
yeah.
and also Bond's death and Felix's death and, you know, even throw in a little bit of Blofeld because even though he's the villain, you know, we always want Blofeld to still be around, even when he falls down a big
smokestack.
You know, which
yeah.
I guess they by rights, the legalities, they couldn't call him Blofeld, but we all know it was Blofeld.
That's right. Yeah, they couldn't give him any name or anything. Basically, bald guy in the wheelchair. That's what it was.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, I mean, I literally, I've never seen a movie that did that to me, where it played with my emotions that bad to where I literally
yeah.
felt like I was gonna be sick. I was going to be physically sick. You know, and even the whole weekend, I was like, I don't know how I feel right now. I feel very unsettled. I don't feel very good. Like, it's weird. I can't describe it.
Yeah, I can kind of relate. I mean, you more so, of course, but I was not happy. And I think, well, I saw it on a Friday when it came out that day. The night before, a TV show, which probably was only I watch. It was called The Outpost. It was more a fantasy show. And that had its finale. And I was like, I'm a little depressed of that alone. And then to go see, you know, because I thought that had more future, you know, where it should have, but the ratings just weren't there. But
yeah.
with Bond, I'm like, this is part of, you know, part of my life, you know, like, now, what do you think then is the future? Because we know it says right there, Bond will, you know, James Bond will return. It doesn't say 007 will return. It says James Bond will return. So are we
going
to see?
I mean, most what I'm thinking and what bothers me about this is the fact that we were always, you know, led to believe that James Bond was one person. You know, you had six actors play him, but he was one person. And he
right.
was always going to be there. He was always going to save the day. He was always going to be the hero. And you're going to leave the theater or you're going to leave your viewing experience on a high note that the hero saved the day. And
right.
you didn't get it with this. You know, yes, he sacrificed himself. And, yes, his family is going to live. But what I'm thinking they're probably going to do is that they're just going to reboot the damn thing all over again. What I really hope that they do is that they don't try to give us backstory again. I don't want to see Bond when
right.
he's young. I don't want to see him inexperienced. I don't want to know who his family is. I want a good old action, fun adventure film with exotic locations, the girls, the gadgets, you know, the fun of a Bond movie. And, you know, the fact that, you know, Eon and Barbara Broccoli and Michael Wilson took the risk. I mean, it's in a way it's bold. In another way, it's absolutely crazy because we're not talking about Spider-Man where you can have Tobey Maguire play him in one set of movies and then,
yeah.
you know, basically reboot it with another guy and start a whole new kind of chapter. This is, you know, and I guess they can do what they want because obviously they own the rights. They're the custodians. They're the keepers of the flame. And they, you know, they've been doing this for a long time. But it's one of those things where it's almost like I don't really understand why they gave Daniel Craig so much creative control. They made him a co-producer.
Yeah, it was his decision to do this. If it was a condition of his doing that last movie from what I heard that directly from himself in an interview.
And in all honesty, the ending of Spectre where he's in the car with her and they drive off into the sunset, I thought was a better ending. They could have done
yeah.
that in this one and not done that in the other one.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, I just feel artistically, you know, what they tried to do was bold and brave and blah, blah, blah. But it really did piss off a lot of fans. And I did not mm-hmm. leave the drive-in feeling happy. I felt miserable.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it really does change my view in a lot of ways on the series. And, you know, because, yeah, granted, I still have all the other ones to watch and everything else. But it's almost like a piece of the childhood has now been retired in a way. And I'm hoping that when they reboot it again with a new actor, they go back to making standalone adventure films and not having to connect them with common themes, common threads, trying to retcon, trying to do a story arc when they don't have it planned out. I'm hoping they just go back to basics and they just make good movies again. I really do. But that not saying that No Time to Die wasn't a good movie. It was a very well-made movie. There are a lot of plot holes. Anna de Armas should have had more screen time. She was fantastic in it.
I loved her action scenes, and that she was kind of the rookie of them, but she was delightful. There was something about her that was very upbeat and cute, and
I thought she was great and underused. I even thought the other one, Nomi, was underused too.
5 minutes left.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We have 5 minutes left.
5 minutes.
Okay. I knew that was coming.
So the one who played Nomi, she was good, but they didn't give her enough of a part. She was almost there to get in his way, to give him back his number, and then to rescue Madeline and Mathilde from the island. That was basically her function, and I felt they really underused her as well. And Rami Malek was good, but once again, I didn't really know. Here's the thing. He killed Blofeld, and he got Spectre. He had no real reason. Why was he destroying the world with this virus? It didn't make sense to me. I don't know why he was now a villain when he rescued Madeline from the ice, and he just seemed to be kind of like a wackadoo, but you don't really know why he was doing what he was doing. It was almost like a big plot hole, in my opinion.
And that last scene, especially with the outfit that they had on him, all I can think of is if they ever – like, he could have played Dr. No because he had that, like, look to him as a young Dr. No, Joseph Weissman. But, Jason, thank you so much for coming on and doing this. We must do this again because there's so many aspects of James Bond that we could go off on a tangent on. The music, certain movies, but I think we both needed to decompress from – from this one.
Yeah, and take a lot of pills to get over it.
even if this was a conversation of just the two of us, which, maybe it is, I don't know, but I don't think so. But it would be worth it because we needed to both, like a therapy group of Bond,
I agree, Bob. It was great being here as well. Thank you for having me.
And Hercules always asks us to provide our, so plug your website or your contact information.
Sure, jasonallentoff.com.
And of course, I can be reached at usschallenger.org, or the USS Challenger Facebook page, or my own Facebook page. There's ways you can reach me. So thank you, Hercules, for letting me do this once again. Get spaced out for you, and
thank you. And thank you very much, also, Jason. I learned a lot about James Bond today, and I'm curious about the franchise. I think the last movie I saw was Dr. No when I was a kid.
Wow.
So now I'm curious about it, so we'll pursue it. Thank you both so very much, and thanks to everybody who tuned in, whether you called in our queue, whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, or whether you'll be checking us out later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. And, of course, we're always looking forward to the next edition of Spaced Out with Bob Vossler. Take care, everybody.
Good night. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Great.
If you can dream. If you can fly, then your heart can touch the sky. But only if you can dream.